And so we're joined now on the Fresh Air News Hour by Ian Murray, MP. Ian has been the Labour MP for Edinburgh South since 2010. He served as the Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland from 2015 to 2016 under Jeremy Corbyn before resigning following the vote to leave the EU, citing criticisms of Mr Corbyn's leadership. And he's now back in the role of Shadow Secretary of State for Scotland under Keir Starmer. Ian, welcome to Fresh Air Radio.
Great to be here. My old alumni, of course. I did some work for Fresh Air back in the 90s.
Yes, I was going to say, I had been sort of relatively reliably informed that that was the case. So you're an alumni of Edinburgh Uni as well, I'm guessing.
That's right, yes. Yeah, and I did some stints on Fresh Air FM. Well, yeah. Must have been, my goodness, when would that have been now? 92, 93 maybe?
Wow, well, good to be back, 30 years on.
It's great, and it's great, yes, it's great, it still runs.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. So if I may, I'd like to start with some sort of more immediate issues, some stuff that's really in the news at the moment. And of course, the main story on everyone's mind at the moment is the situation in Ukraine, the ongoing crisis on their border with Russia. So in the last few days, there have been signs of potential easing of tensions at the border. And on Monday, we had President Biden saying that he isn't going to do anything or go anywhere without the UK at his side. How well do you think the British government so far have handled this crisis?
I mean, yes, what we've done as an opposition is back the UK government's approach to this, because really we need the de-escalation, the demilitarisation, and we need diplomacy to work. And the only way you can get diplomacy to work is for people to speak with one voice, and NATO being the body which would take a lot of these things forward. But of course, the two big players in NATO are indeed the US and the UK. So it's really important for NATO to realise that they have the backing of the entirety of the UK Parliament, and that the President of the United States understands that as well. And I think the diplomatic efforts that are being put in are really the only way to resolve this issue. And we did have a chink of light on Monday evening with the President of the United States saying that there looks as though there might be some movement. But of course, we haven't as yet seen. And I believe from this moment in time we're recording this, the President of Ukraine has said that there hasn't been any visible signs yet of Russia retracting some of its troops on their border. So we'll wait to see what happens with bated breath at the moment, I think.
Yeah, of course. And last year, the sort of the most recent international crisis before this was the one in Afghanistan, the rapid withdrawal of British forces there last August. At that time, Dominic Raab was the Foreign Secretary. We now have a new Foreign Secretary in Liz Truss. Do you think she's doing a strong job on this? Is there anything more you'd like to see her doing?
Well, I mean, the whole Afghanistan withdrawal was a mess. Happened because the UK and the US, as the two primary allied partners, but obviously there was many other countries involved, didn't think that was going to be the outcome. I mean, they thought that if the Taliban was to try and take over Afghanistan, the chances of them taking Kabul was pretty remote. And if they did, it would be months or years. I think it was in a matter of hours they measured it in terms of the way that Afghanistan fell, which created a whole host of other problems, which meant the UK government was unprepared for getting people out. And at this moment in time, we still have the incredibly difficult situation that's devastating for those involved of people who are living their lives in fear in Afghanistan because they have worked for the West, if I can put that in inverted commas, during the last 10 or 12 years and are being hunted down by the Taliban. Now, it's okay in the big cities, but it's not okay in the rural areas. And I've done a lot of work with the Qataris, who have the only staging posts, if you like, in the whole of the region in terms of getting people out. And their problem at the moment is twofold. One is they can only lift someone out on a commercial aircraft, or the only commercial country able to take commercial aircrafts in, if the person who's getting onto that aircraft has somewhere else to go. And secondly, if they can present all their papers. Now, the problem with that is you can only present your papers if you have a passport and the proper documentation. And the only way to get that is to present yourself, all your details and all your information to the Taliban government, and that is just not palatable. So we have an almighty mess in Afghanistan of our own making that doesn't look as if it's going to be resolved anytime soon.
And last week we had Liz Truss in Moscow meeting with the Russian foreign minister. There was quite a lot of tension in that meeting. Towards the end of it, Sergei Lavrov said that the conversation that he had with Liz Truss was, he likened it to one between a deaf person and a mute. Do you think that kind of language was particularly helpful? And I imagine that you and the Labour Party would actually, on that occasion, back Liz Truss and back the British government against that kind of petty diplomacy, some might say.
And with all of these diplomatic efforts, whether it be in Russia or elsewhere, taking the heat and dialing down the rhetoric is always a good starting point. Although it is quite clear that the UK for some years now have had a whole host of pretty poor foreign secretaries, and maybe that response was in to the foreign secretary not being particularly helpful herself, who seems to be using her trips to Russia as a way of advertising her own credentials to be leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister. So there is that undercurrent going on. But yes, I would agree that, you know, the first rule of diplomacy is language, and language is key in these kinds of debates and this kind of issue. And that's not particularly helpful from either side.
Just before we move on the issue of, you know, jockeying for leadership and that kind of thing, what did you think of the photo that emerged of Liz Truss on a trip to Estonia a few months ago, sitting in a tank in basically what was a mirror image of the picture of Margaret Thatcher sitting in a tank in the 1980s? Do you think there's a complete focus on the day job?
Well, this is the biggest question of British politics at the moment. Is there anybody in government concentrating on their day job? My answer would be close to no, because, you know, the Prime Minister is, for want of a better term, given the current discussion we've had, in the trenches and trying to get himself out. We've got people in the cabinet jockeying for position, including Liz Truss and others. We've got people on the back benches trying to inflict the fatal wound on the Prime Minister, people trying to defend him, and others trying to back their preferred candidate. So this whole situation of the last 6 weeks or so has completely paralysed the government, actually. And that kind of paralysis, when you have that kind of vacuum, the vacuum is filled by potential candidates who want to take on the role. And Liz Truss within the Conservative Party membership is very much seeing herself as the heir to Thatcher. And I think that's why you'll start seeing these pretty ridiculous photo calls in the next few weeks of people trying to flex their credentials in terms of what they could provide as leader of the country.
So let's move on to Partygate, which is the story that has dominated British politics for a few months now. What is your honest assessment of the Prime Minister's position? Do you think that he will still be there in 6 months' time?
It's difficult to assess. You know, this individual, Boris Johnson, has had a whole career of fighting fires and holding on. I mean, his last two careers he was sacked from for manipulating the truth, let's say, and he's continued with that particular characteristic since. The reason that this has carried on for so long, of course, isn't because of one individual incident. It's because every time you open a newspaper or turn on the news, there's something new. So it's not as if, you know, these stories tend to be, today's stories tend to be tomorrow's chip wrappers. That's no longer the case with this, because it just keeps going and going. And I think what we don't yet know is the, if I can turn into Donald Rumsfeld for a while, what we don't yet know is what we don't know. And when that comes to pass, that might be even more damaging for the Prime Minister. But it's pretty incredible. It's just setting aside how devastating the issue is and how much sacrifice people had to make during lockdown that the Prime Minister's essentially laughed at. This is a sitting Prime Minister who's just about to be interviewed under caution by the police. First time that has ever happened. That in itself should be a resigning exercise, purely because the Prime Minister, regardless of what colour, requires a moral authority. And when you lose that moral authority in the country, you lose your ability to govern. It paralyses your government, and that's what we're currently seeing. And that's why it's so important. Some people say to me, isn't it in the best interest of the Labour Party for him to stay electorally? Of course it is. But actually, morally and for the state of the country and in the national interest, he has to go.
But do you truly believe that it's in the Labour Party's interest for Boris Johnson to stay? Do you not think, given the failings that he's had in his career in the past and the way he's continued to excel his career and become Prime Minister, do you not think that if he were to stay in position until the next election, he would find a way of turning things around and potentially posing and continuing to pose a major threat to the Labour Party? Do you not think that someone who has less cut through, who has less charisma, for want of a better word, someone like Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak, do you not think they might be a more kind of soft opponent at the next election versus Boris Johnson, who seems to still have a lot of fight left in him?
Yes, I mean, these are questions it's really difficult to answer in that sense, because you just don't know the way things will work out. If you had asked me that question 6 weeks ago, I would have said that, you know, the Labour Party has to learn to fight and counter a much different Conservative Party with a leader that we haven't seen that style of before, and that would be a real challenge for us. And of course, back then, the real impediments to Keir Starmer as Prime Minister was that he was a boring lawyer who was very legalistic and straightforward. Well, in actual fact, those are the characteristics now that are his biggest strength, given what we've seen over the last 6 weeks. So, you know, it's very difficult to determine what might happen at the next election, but I think the die is already cast in terms of the public's mind on this current Prime Minister, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible, for him to turn that around.
So you mentioned Keir Starmer, and we'll come back to kind of the state of the Labour Party in the next election very shortly. But just last week, Keir Starmer was heckled and shouted down by a group of protesters outside Parliament, some of which shouted very unpleasant things about Jimmy Savile, about protecting paedophiles. And that came just 7 days after the Prime Minister had said, you know, words to the same effect in the House of Commons. Do you make a direct link between those two events, between the Prime Minister saying that and between Keir Starmer being heckled in the street?
Well, absolutely, I do. And I think that the kind of responsibility for these kinds of issues comes from the top. Look, can I just be pretty clear with your listeners, Ollie? The Prime Minister made this up. This is a total and utter fabrication. And neither the Prime Minister or any of his ministers or anybody who wants to defend this will repeat these allegations out with parliamentary privilege, because they know they would be breaking the law. What happened was that the Southeast branch of the Crown Prosecution Service in England didn't have enough evidence from three complaints to prosecute Jimmy Savile on those three occasions, primarily because the allegations came from people who would not testify. And it transpires many, many years later that as director of the Crown Prosecution Service, Keir Starmer apologised on behalf of the CPS for not prosecuting at that time. Now, that's the equivalent of David Cameron apologising for Bloody Sunday. You wouldn't say that then David Cameron was responsible for it. It's what responsible leaders of organisations who go through a process of change and a process of admittance and a process of healing that they do. What the Prime Minister is trying to do is to conflate that with a far-right Facebook trope that Keir Starmer was didn't prosecute Jimmy Savile. Now, the Prime Minister was advised by his advisers, who have subsequently resigned, not to do this because it is a total lie and false, but he did it anyway. And if you therefore then have an angry mob shouting paedophiles and Jimmy Savile and all that at the leader of the opposition while he's walking down Whitehall doing his job, then there's only one conclusion you can come to. And in actual fact, the Prime Minister should apologise, should retract the comments, say that they were wrong and fabricated, and encourage people not to use them. But he does this deliberately because he knows the consequences of it. And if you just look at social media, the people who don't like Keir Starmer or the Labour Party or want to defend the Prime Minister, Jimmy Savile is now the way they're doing it. So he knew exactly what he was doing. It's pretty disgusting. It's the worst gutter form of politics. And the only way to stop this now is for the Prime Minister to resign and retract them.
But he's sort of verged on repeating them in public. Members of the government have said that this is just the cut and thrust of politics. This is what it's like to be at the top of British politics. Do you worry about the normalisation, not just of accusations that are false, but, you know, the normalisation of violence around Parliament? We've seen other MPs, we've seen journalists harassed in recent years. Given the death of the tragic death of David Amos MP last year, Joe Cox 5 or 6 years ago, do you worry about the state of politics, the increasingly violent state of politics?
I do, and I worry about it for all of those reasons you've just laid out in your question, but I worry about it more because the kind of stoking of all this violence and unrest and division starts at the top. If the Prime Minister thinks it's appropriate, it's not the cut and thrust of politics. The cut and thrust of politics is debate, is indifference. It's about arguing separate points. It's about agreeing to disagree. That's the cut and thrust of politics. What is not the cut and thrust of politics is to completely make up a story about your opponent in the hope that people think it's true in order to damage them. And that's what's wrong. And that just gives a free license to all these people, all these idiots who think it's appropriate not only to shout and to accuse and to attack politicians, but whatever they're attacking, abusing and shouting at in public life or otherwise, it's just not acceptable. And the Prime Minister should know better and does know better. And that's the problem. He knew the consequences of what he was about to do. David Amos was murdered in Southend-on-Sea. A backbench Conservative MP for 40 years had no profile at all in the country as such. But somebody sought out to brutally murder him. Joe Cox, similarly. And, you know, I never thought I'd be in a position as an elected member 12 years in where I have panic buttons and my staff have panic buttons next to their desks and we have a door entry system that nobody gets in now without them being properly screened and there's no publishing of the diary. That's not the way politics should be. I should be the most accessible person in the community. And because of this and because of incidents like this, we're not. And that's what's really sad about this. We should cherish what we have. The part of the democracy of this country we should cherish the most is the ability for you, Ollie, your friends, your neighbours and anyone to stop me in the supermarket or come into my office and have a meeting and a discussion about a personal problem or a big issue or a lobbying thing or whatever. That's what democracy should be. And I hate the fact that we could end up in an Americanization of politics where you elect your politician and then you never see them because you're not allowed.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. It's one on a lot of people's minds. If we may, I'd like to move on to the Labour Party. We've touched on it briefly. So you are now consistently polling ahead of the Tories, which obviously for you is a good thing. But a lot of the data shows that en masse, voters aren't necessarily moving from the Conservatives to Labour, but rather away from the Conservatives to a number of options, whether that be apathy, not wanting to vote at all, or not knowing who to vote for. And obviously some of them are going to Labour. Does that worry you? Do you think Labour could be doing more to attract former Conservative voters?
It doesn't worry me as such because there's two parts to this. In fact, there's several parts to this, but the two main parts are, of course, to win a general election, you need the voters who didn't vote for you in the previous elections to change allegiance. And that's what we're working on. And I think Partygate and the way in which this government has conducted itself, the waste, the cronyism, all the stories that we read day in, day out about this government has meant that a large proportion of those people who voted for the Conservatives in 2019 have left their column. Now, the second part of that is the Labour Party needs to give them an opportunity to come back. And that's what Keir Starmer's trying to do or been trying to do over the last few months. He's laid out his broad framework in terms of security, respect and prosperity. He's building on each of those elements in terms of what the country would look like. He wants to have a story about the country being the best possible place it can be and about doing things differently. So they've left the Conservatives. We now need to seal the deal with our policy platform and the way we have a story for the future of the country to bring them across. That part, you know, given we're only in 2022, takes a long time to develop.
Sure, but when is that policy platform going to emerge? Because as you say, we're in 2022, so an election is scheduled for 2024, but it could indeed be next year. When is Keir Starmer going to publicly develop the core policies on which a new Labour government will be founded? Because what a lot of people say is that, yes, Keir Starmer has turned around the culture of the party. Anti-Semitism is, you know, certainly more a thing of the past than it was under Jeremy Corbyn. In the last 6 weeks, he's strategically got a lot of things right in Parliament and in the media. But actually what's missing is a core policy platform through which people can identify with the party. When is that coming and what will it look like?
Yeah, but all this stuff takes time. I mean, if I asked you to guess how many policies that we've announced since the last election, you wouldn't believe there's over 200. And the reason that you wouldn't believe there's over 200 is because we don't have the compelling story to go with it. So what Keir has to do and what the party has to do, certainly it's the responsibility of people like myself in the Shadow Cabinet, is to start articulating that story for the country. And then the rest of the policy falls from that. So the big thing we've been talking about over the last few months has been the cost of living crisis, which affects students actually more than it affects most. in terms of the soaring bills and the likes. And we've had a very strong policy on that to tax the oil and gas companies in order to be able to provide £600 to the poorest households and £200 for everybody to help them with their bills. So that's a really strong policy. Now, that's not a policy that wins you the next general election because it's a single policy. But the whole broad narrative of that is that those with the broadest shoulders who've got extra should be helping in times of crisis for those that don't. And there's no bigger crisis than energy bills spiking the way they are. That's just one example. The whole story of the economy, the whole story of the future of jobs. Rachel Reeves announced just before Christmas a £28 billion funded package for new green jobs and technologies. That's incredibly important for the future of the economy and careers, for the future of science, for laying out a roadmap so people can invest. So these are the kind of things that are detailed policies. But until you've got that story for the country, which Keir's unpacking at the moment in terms of his respect, prosperity and security agenda, it doesn't really fit anywhere. So it's a combination of both. And in terms, I understand people's frustration because they want Labour to be coming out with a whole host of transformative policies. We will. But it's important to do them right, but it's also important to get the narrative and the story together first, which is what is Keir's building on at the moment.
Sure, and talking about that kind of branding that goes alongside the policies, it feels to me as if there is still a bit of a hangover from the Jeremy Corbyn years, not necessarily reflected in the leadership of the party, but from those years, a number of MPs have gained a really high profile in the media and in the country. And take the Ukraine issue. MPs such as Diane Abbott, Richard Bergen, John McDonnell, they have appeared on the media and they have struggled to criticise certain powers which some might expect them to criticise, Russia, China, etc. And so whether they're a reflection of the Labour leadership or not is almost irrelevant, because if you have a panel programme, let's say a radio or a television programme, and Diane Abbott or Richard Bergen is representing the Labour Party on that programme, and they deliver remarks about NATO or the West in general that are kind of critical in relation to Ukraine and other foreign affairs, that tars the whole Labour Party with the same brush, doesn't it? So what would your message to those MPs be, given that they seem to be singing from a different hymn sheet to the rest of the Labour Party?
Well, when they go on these panel shows, they're not representing the Labour Party because there won't be an official Labour Party spokesperson.
Sure, but it's likely they will be the only Labour voice on the panel. So,
of course, yeah. Of course. And that does tarnish the party. And look, I've said all the way through this for the last few years, Ollie, and this is really important, that we've got to make a decision as a society and as a party, if we want to be in power or we want to be a pressure group shouting from the sidelines. I don't want the latter, and I don't want the latter for a number of reasons, because you can do nothing without the levers of power. And we've proved in the past with our very proud record and all the governments we have, 50, 45, 64, 74, 97, that in power we can do that transformative change. The history is there to show that we can do it. And that's for us to lay out. If people want to go on the media to be from within the party to be critical of the party, then all they're doing is doing the Conservatives' bidding for them. And the prime example for that would be the party leadership refused in the run-up to 2019 election to decide that they either wanted to win it or even try and win it, and then become about political purity, and the public had their say, the worst general election result in 100 years. They need to reflect very seriously on what that means. And what that means, not just for the Labour Party, but for the country. And we're living through that now. So they're wrong. They are entitled to their views. Of course they are. But they're not entitled to express those views on behalf of the Labour Party. And it's a real problem. We either all row in the same direction to win and to try and get the country back into the place that it should be, or we perpetually sit as a pressure group shouting from the sidelines. And the latter is just of no interest to me as a Labour politician, because it doesn't help the constituents that I seek to represent.
And in the next few weeks, Labour selections for the next general election will be taking place. It's possible that Jeremy Corbyn, therefore, well, it's highly likely that Jeremy Corbyn won't be selected as the Labour candidate, given that he is currently not a Labour MP. So we're going to have a situation in Islington North at the next election where Jeremy Corbyn will be going up against someone nominated by the Labour Party. That's going to be quite a nasty local battle, isn't it?
Well, but it's a battle brought on by himself. You know,
the
party Yeah. The party, I mean, your listeners may know the potted history, so very, very quickly, you know, the EHRC report into anti-Semitism in the Labour Party was damning. And that damning report had to be legally and morally taken on with all its recommendations. This is a legal report. And Keir Starmer, to his credit, said, yes, we will implement all the recommendations of the EHRC report, get this cancer of anti-Semitism out of the Labour Party and move forward. Jeremy Corbyn refuses to accept that. So he has, in terms of the whip, the chief whip has said to Jeremy, there are three conditions for you becoming a Labour MP. One is you delete the tweet. Second is you apologise. And third, you accept the EHRC report. He refuses to do so. And therefore, whether it be Jeremy Corbyn, myself, or any other member of the Parliamentary Labour Party, is in breach of the Labour Party's rules and therefore no longer can be sitting with the whip for the Labour Party. It's as simple and straightforward as that.
And what do you say to students who might be listening, who might have voted for Jeremy Corbyn in 2019, who might be big supporters of him, and think, do you know what, I don't want anything to do with the Labour Party that doesn't have him in it anymore? What's your message to them?
Well, my message to them is to help us win. You know, students who've just in first year at university, or myself or my grandparents, are all frustrated with this dreadful Conservative government. We know the country can be better. We know morally it can be better. We know economically it can be better. We know it can be better for every age group, including and students. But it's bigger than one person. And the result of the 2019 general election was an 80-seat Conservative majority. That is the legacy that has been left. So when everyone says to me, why are we not winning votes in Parliament? Well, mathematically, we just can't. So we've just got to try and use other tools at our disposal. We have the opportunity to replace this Conservative government whenever this next general election comes along. Come and help us to do that. Put your cross in the Labour box to help us win. And I can 1,000,000% promise you, you will not be disappointed. But you will be disappointed if you wake up the day after polling day and Boris Johnson or some other Conservative Party leader has his fist raised outside Downing Street celebrating another victory. That is the legacy that Jeremy Corbyn left us, and it's not a legacy I'm willing to accept.
Fascinating. Briefly, I'd like to talk about Scotland as well. Independence is still an issue, certainly in the eyes of Nicola Sturgeon. Increasingly, the SNP make emotive rather than technical or economic arguments in favour of independence. Scotland generally, a lot of people in Scotland are on the centre-left of politics. And so the emotive argument that Nicola Sturgeon makes is, well, why would you want to be part of a UK which perpetually gives you Tory governments, which is perpetually run by individuals like Boris Johnson? That's an incredibly strong argument. How can the Labour Party counter that in Scotland?
Well, don't forget, Nicola Sturgeon said at the 2019 general election for people in England to vote Green. She's no aspiration to have a Labour government. In fact, she knows a UK Labour government is the biggest impediment to her aspirations for an independent Scotland.
And just quickly, is that a red line for you, cooperation with the SNP after a general election in order to gain a majority?
Yes, because we don't agree with them principally on the reason that they exist. And you couldn't possibly have a situation where we want to protect the UK. So what will happen at the next election is that we will have our own constitutional offering in the manifesto, and if we're lucky enough to be in power to deliver it, we'll deliver that constitutional offering. And what Keir Starmer will be saying is not, I'm going to be the UK Prime Minister to persuade you to stay. He's going to be saying to Scots, I'm going to make Britain the best possible place it can be that you'll want to stay. And I think that change in tone and emphasis are a really strong one. And the reason the SNP use emotional arguments is because they don't have any practical ones. And I do get the emotional stuff. You know, I'm a passionate Scot. I was born, brought up, went to Edinburgh University. I support Scotland, whether they're playing international football and rugby or tiddlywinks. It doesn't really matter. Very, very proud to be a Scot, but I could be a patriot without being a nationalist. And I just don't feel that it's in the interest of Scotland or the rest of the UK for Scotland to leave. And if you see in the last few weeks, and just ask the questions, and this is all I say to people, the emotional arguments are very strong, because of course they are. This is nationalism we're talking about. But just ask the questions yourself. And if you look at what's happened this week with a journalist asking Ian Blackford about pensions, you know, that's falling apart. Ask about currency, that's falling apart. Ask about borders, that's falling apart. Deficit and debt, falling apart. And the reason it's falling apart is because the answers to those questions, in truth, are unpalatable, or they don't have them. And if we think Brexit is bad, and Brexit is bad and something the country should never have done to itself, Scottish independence would be Brexit with bells on times 10. And that really is something that I cannot in all conscience support whilst wanting the best for the people of the country.
And just finally, I must let you go very shortly, but just finally on students, of course, this is student radio. It'll be majority students listening. Students, if I may say so, have had a rotten deal in the pandemic. Mm. I didn't go into university. I'm in my third year. I didn't go into university for over 18 months. Obviously, we had online provision, but it wasn't the same. Do you have any idea of what the Labour Party's position is going to be at the next election on any kind of compensation adjustment to student tuition fees, either as a result of the pandemic or more generally a different deal for students?
Well, that kind of detail will depend on what the environment is as we get closer to the election. So I don't have a straight answer for you at this particular moment in time, but we do have an answer in terms of the recognition of the hardship that students have gone through. Of course, academically, students are still able to do things online, but that is only a very small part of the student experience. I've just locally had a whole host of students get in touch about not having yet in-person lectures and tutorials, written to the principal and the vice chancellor, and hopefully everyone will be back to normal pretty soon. But this has been nearly 2 years, and it's completely unacceptable for people to be paying high fees or even just very high living costs if you're not paying fees and not getting the service from the university that you deserve and that they should be giving. I do think, maybe slightly controversially, that universities and some organisations have used COVID as a little bit of an excuse not to get back to normal. And there's obviously industrial action still going on at universities in terms of the rights, workers' rights and pensions of the staff. That's got to be resolved. But the big thing, I think, at the moment in terms of your listeners, in terms of politics and where we are and the whole point of being a student is the cost of living crisis is hitting students hard, much, much harder than it's hitting lots of parts of society, because there are you have a fixed income or a very low income, but you've still got to pay those gas and electricity bills. You've still got to buy food. I'm sure the price of a pint is much higher than it was before. It certainly is in my local, and those kinds of issues. But the serious point is that being a student is about the student life. It's not just about the textbooks and the exams. And I feel heart sorry for students who not only haven't been on campus for 18 months or 2 years, but the cost of living crisis is just making it impossible with rents and others to survive and to do it properly and to enjoy it. And that's what I feel is a rite of passage being a student, and it will affect the rest of your life. And I feel as if that experience is being taken away from students at the moment.
Yeah, sure. I know a lot of our listeners will definitely relate to all of that. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you back 30 years on from your time on Fresh Air. Ian Murray, MP, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Ollie.